Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Sandeep Roy, editor with New America Media, and host of Upfront on KALW 91.7 FM. It's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Michael Eric Dyson, renowned academic, public intellectual, and now author of Debating Race with Michael Eric Dyson. When your book comes with blurbs from both Ann Coulter and Cornel West, you know this is someone who can really speak to a spectrum of people. Michael Eric Dyson is the host of the nationally syndicated Michael Eric Dyson Show on radio. He's an advice columnist for Essence. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania and a Baptist minister. He's been named one of the 100 most influential Black Americans by Ebony. And in his spare time, he's written over a dozen books, including Come Hell or High Water about Katrina's aftermath. And his latest is Debating Race with Michael Eric Dyson. We're excited he's joining us today to do what he does best, exchange ideas. Please welcome Dr. Michael Eric Dyson.
Thank you so kindly, Brother Sandeep, for that generous introduction and for the Commonwealth Club of California's gracious extension of yet another opportunity to chat a bit about ideas which are central to the American compact. Race, of course, is, to my mind, still the central and bewitching American problem. We live in a nation which, ironically enough, owes a debt of design to the deleterious outlines of race because this nation was shaped in the crucible of slavery and articulated its values of democracy against the backdrop of their contradiction in its own practices. The ideal of freedom, justice, and equality prevailed, while the practices upon which those assertions rested, paradoxically enough, were the enslavement of Black human beings that allowed many mainstream Americans the privilege to doubt the humanity or work ethic of African Americans. But drawing out from there, America has been, in a very interesting and profound fashion, continually dogged by the question of race and almost in inverse proportion to its willingness to engage the problem out front. We live in what has been termed the United States of amnesia. We know that Barbara Streisand has often supplied the theme song, "What's Too Painful to Remember, We Simply Choose to Forget." And so the forgetting is seductive. The amnesia prevails as a desirable practice precisely because America is loath to deal publicly and explicitly with this problem for long periods of time. To be sure, the reality is that in this nation, we have confronted the reality and the history of racial oppression at various points and times. Think of course, the Civil War. Think about the struggle over slavery. Think about the debate within the states as to whether or not this nation would remain half free and half slave, as Mr. Lincoln memorably phrased it. Think about the attempt of many Americans to move beyond the schisms that were introduced as a result of racial difference and racial subordination in post-Reconstruction America, where for a while it looked as if the nation was willing to invest its deepest and most profound energy in trying to resist the vicious and awful onset of beliefs about Black and white and other ethnicities and racial identities, and finally edify and hold up a vision of America that transcended tribe and looked beyond the pale
to embrace all Americans as one. But quickly, E Pluribus Unum, out of many one, faded into the sunset as the common practice of racial division took root and Jim Crow became a reality and debt peonage through sharecropping became the practice in American society for many former slaves who barely could tell the difference because now they existed in another world, a halfway house between the embrace of freedom and its promise, and on the other hand, the real powerful rejection and repudiation of those ideas in the everyday lives of ordinary people. So when we think about tracing the trajectory of the struggle for freedom and justice and equality in America through simply the lives of African-American people, though we know, especially in these parts, that race is much larger than black and white, we see the constant struggle from slavery to Jim Crow down to the struggle for civil rights and the best of American society being articulated in the likes of a Martin Luther King Jr. or an Ella Baker or a Joanne Robinson and a Rosa Parks. And then we live now in a nation where there has been the convergence of so many interesting streams of difference flowing into the grand ocean of this national consensus about the American compact. Who we are as a nation is constantly up now or for debate because the powerful and searing debates that occur around the issue of race mean that this nation is at least vital and alive, though often indifferent to traditions of subtlety and nuance and complexity, in deference to notions of ideological opposition that is so extreme that neither the left nor the right or those in the middle can connect. And so in my book, Debating Race, it is an attempt to present before the public a broad variety of ideas and identities and ideals that are articulated from a vast range of interlocutors and allowing me to weave a thread throughout the proceedings that allows hopefully passionate intensity to accompany with analytical acuity on the part at least of those with whom I speak. And so whether we're speaking about affirmative action with Mr. Ward Connerly, not unbeknownst to these parts, a man who has led California in the rejection of affirmative action as an official practice and followed up with Michigan, my home state, and now attempting to spread, some would say, his vision, others would say his virus, to other states. And in my debate with Mr. Connerly, it is a rather intense, though hopefully civil exchange, about some fundamental issues in America that often are beclouded in either mystery or misperception, misinformation, and even disinformation. And so Mr. Connerly says, taking the language of the 64 Bill of Rights, Civil Rights Bill, that he wants to see a nation, 64 and 65, he wants to see a nation that adheres to those principles and practices, those ideals, that America would never privilege race or gender or class or sexual orientation, we might add later, or religion as the basis for distributing a good like education or employment. And he then seizes upon the words of Martin Luther King Jr., which have been extricated from their original context, torn from their original ideological and political sentiments, and then put into service by those who were opposed to King to begin with. 34 words he uttered when he was 34 years old. I have a dream one day my four little children will live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. An ideal, to be sure, to be embraced upon the horizon as a potential meaning for the American contract. But the reality is that those words were a regulative ideal, a governing norm. They were to prevail as America proceeded to the practices of freedom, justice, and democracy. They ain't there yet. But many conservative brothers and sisters pretend as if they have already arrived and having been achieved, now we must, in the aftermath of that recognition of their achievement, proceed as if race does not make a difference. But only a person deeply in the embrace of a rigid right-wing conservative viewpoint, or otherwise having lost one's perspective upon the landscape that is occupied by such consternating and contradictory visions of race, where it's obvious, as Diva Pager, the sociologist in New York, or at Princeton University, upon studying New York, said you could be a white guy with a criminal record and get a job quicker than a black man who never had a criminal record. That suggests to us that something else is afoot, that the persistence of age-old bigotries and ancient prejudices have their sway over the contemporary lives of African-American people and many others. And as a result of that, it would be foolish of us to suggest that Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream had all of a sudden willy-nilly been made into reality, that it had apparently materialized in such a decisive fashion. And so I argue with him. He pushes me at one point. Well, Michael, what do you mean? How long should we have affirmative action? I said, Ward, I ain't trying to get no number to it. But if you want to push me, let's just be equal then. Let's just have affirmative action as long as we had slavery and call it a day. It is amazing and interesting to me and a source of endless fascination that in this country where history matters so much, where we have books upon Lincoln and Franklin and Hamilton being issued time and again by various authors who have their particular take on the founding fathers, the founding brothers, the founding mothers, the founding sisters. We might get a book soon about the founding brothers of this nation. That's B-R-O-T-H-A-S for those who may not be intimately acquainted with the nuances of vernacular. So what's interesting then is that with the fascination with, some would say romantic preoccupation with, isn't it interesting that women and other minorities are often accused of being deeply compensatory in their romantic embrace of their tribe to the exclusion of others? And yet America is fascinated with Jefferson and endlessly engaged with Lincoln, book after book, text after text, and often not grappling with the contradictions but asserting the flawless perfectionism of their heroic figures. And so it is quite interesting to me that an America that is obsessed with history like that could be so obviously denying of history on the other hand. And that those of us who bring up, who prick the conscience of America by suggesting maybe all is not well in Denmark, that there's something wrong, that we are the ones who are accused of being somehow an ethnosaur, a recalcitrant recluse of race, insisting upon digging up the bleached bones and the relics of a racial past that has long since passed off of this earth, a Paleolithic racial period. But I think that the stuff is still real when I look at Michael Richards, who got consumed with the racial Holy Ghost and spoke in some vile racial tongues. He said he had never heard those terms before. Where did they come from? The racial Holy Ghost descended upon him. Nigger, lynching, fork. I mean, isn't it interesting that a pool of racial sentiment exists apart from one's own conscious stream of thought, and that collectively this collective racial unconscious informs even people who have never explicitly articulated a racial epithet in their lives, but at a moment of convenient anger, call upon that sentiment to shape their ideal and perception. The language tumbles forth as effortlessly as if they had said it 1,000 times before. And so that reminds us that we still live in funky conditions. Foul and nefarious practices prevail, and not simply about personal sentiment, structural practices, because we get confused in America between, on the one hand, the persistence of bigotry and prejudice, where we say, isn't everybody a bigot and a prejudiced? Black people are the same way. You people, too, have problems. True indeed. Everybody can be a bigot. Everybody can't be a racist in the same structural fashion as white supremacy has mandated in America, and people seem to get confused about that. Every race, tribe, region, group of people can certainly harbor vicious beliefs about another. Stereotypes, after all, are shorthand for people who are lazy. Stereotypes are the shorthand of lazy people who don't want to do the hard work of investigating the other. So all of us are masked in stereotype, articulating behind the logic of our own tribe what we think the other is about, and whether those are edifying or degrading stereotypes, because, you know, you can foster both. The reality is that that's the lazy work, as opposed to seeing human beings as complex amalgams of the good and the bad. That's the problem with stereotype. It takes you feeling that your group or tribe is perfect and the other groups are not perfect in order to articulate a vision about the other that degrades them, and you get brownie points for being just a bit better, a kind of implicit superior complex, a supremacist complex, and every group can be subject to that. However, in America, it is interesting to note that the structural realities of race are different than those individual ones, because everybody hasn't been demonized in America as three-fifths human. Black people have been, and as a result of that, certain epithets connected to African-American people have had the adjunct of, the accompaniment of, a vicious symphony of action and behavior that reinforces that epithet with material density, with real problematic practices, not just the word N-word. It's been accompanied by lynching and stabbing and murdering and maiming and harming and raping. And so as a result of that, we live in a nation again that has confused terms and failed to understand differences, even as we must acknowledge that each group is embracing stereotypes and bigotry and prejudice against other groups in defense of their own alleged and ostensible purity. And so in this book, I wanted to have people, whether Ward Connolly or David Horowitz, when we talk about affirmative action, but not only that, but reparations for slavery or an apology for slavery. This is a nation that can't even say, I'm sorry. You know, if you mess up with your husband or wife or your loved one, and you go to the crib that night, and you ain't saying nothing like you sorry, I messed up, and baby, watch what you eat. That's all I'm saying to you. Brother had a song, Sleeping With One Eye Open. Just be careful now. Don't think you're going to mess up that often and ain't going to pay no consequence. Ain't no price to be paid. But isn't it interesting that even if we step on somebody's foot, we know quickly to say I'm sorry, especially in loaded, charged urban zones where small rituals of insult are magnified to homicidal proportions. So we know if you mess up, you ought to fess up. But except in America. Yeah, we had slavery, but damn it, it's been 400 years. Let's go on. What the hell? Right? This is what my man said in Virginia, didn't he? 79 years old, state senator. Black folk just need to get over it. Would we dare say to Jewish brothers and sisters, get over the Holocaust? Would we dare say to brothers and sisters who are Japanese, get over the internment and the Second World War? We can't just dismiss people's pain and their problems and the plagues to which they're subject. You're suffering from cancer. Get over it. Get your chemo and be quiet. How dare we dismiss the legitimate suffering of another and pretend somehow that in the dismissal is our obligation to remain silent about the plague that consumes. And so this book is breaking faith with that implicit conception and compact in America that to be silent about it is to let it go, to pretend it doesn't exist. But we got to confront it, and we got to confront it on many areas and regions. And I also speak in the book about this black-brown tension and this tension between so-called borders in America and those of us who live here. The Mexicans are coming. They forget to say back. You kicking people out and forget they was at the crib. That's like ripping somebody's house off. Then you've been there so long, when they come back, finally find their way back to your crib and get away back, you mad because you own the place and calling them the interloper. Now, whether or not you get into that kind of long historical argument is nearly irrelevant. What is true is the fact that we live in a nation now that when Jurgen is trying to get here, it's unproblematic to come to the super information highway, to the valley of possibility with the cyber information age running amok. Silicon Valley had no problem with Jurgen from Germany, but Jose from Mexico is a problem. People get upset, black people, they taking our jobs. Many white people, what the hell are they doing? Speaking Spanish, don't want to talk English. Black people, you say, what job they taking you had? You wasn't working that job, homeboy. $2.50. And black people don't know. And why should we apologize for not working a $2.50 hour job? Because Mexican brothers and sisters should be making a minimum wage, too. So let's not brag, as Vicente Fox did, the president of Mexico. They'll take jobs that even Negroes want, that even black people want. Well, don't brag about that, homeboy, because we at the bottom of the barrel. Scraping hard, but we want minimum wage. You know, black people want all day breaks. I want my coffee break, two cigarette breaks, and a brush my teeth break. I see it in the contract, and I'm taking it. And why shouldn't he? Working hard in a country that refuses often to recognize the value of that labor. And so why should Mexican brothers and sisters, and among many other immigrants, why do we reduce it only to Mexicans, but Mexicans become the bete noire, to become the poster children for all this wrong? And here in California, of course you know, with the heavy influx of Mexican brothers and sisters who have made the economy vibrant, who have made the possibility for you having nannies and butchers and people who clean in your crib. How are they going to be called lazy through stereotype and they cleaning all the places and doing all the work? In fact, they'd probably be the ones to erect the wall against Mexicans coming in. Some other Mexicans being put to work, this illegal labor. And I'm not arguing that the problem is that simple and that we can therefore dismiss anybody who raises questions about immigration as somehow being prejudiced or racist. What I'm saying is that why do we get obsessed with it when only certain groups are trying to flood those borders? Most people in America are immigrants, besides us coerced immigrants, forced immigrants. Didn't really want to come here, but now that we're here, got to make the best of it. Ain't trying to go nowhere, being treated like internal tourists and immigrants, despite having been born here for centuries and centuries. And so the reality is, my brothers and sisters, that's the difficulty that we must grapple with. And then we want to say to black brothers and sisters, don't internalize the same kind of hatred of the other that is articulated at the level of the brown body. At the same time, we know studies have been done. Many Mexicans and other immigrants come here with the same viewpoints and stereotypes about black people that the larger majority has. And in their own nation, they brought them with them because Afro-Latinos are not often spoken about. The African dimensions of Latino identity are often submerged in conversations about the exponential increase of the Latino population. Might be a few more brothers counted up in there if you would do the math right. That's fuzzy immigrant math, because the suppression of the Afro-Latino identity. If Elian Gonzalez had been from San Diego to Cuba as opposed to Havana, they might have gave him a Snickers bar and said, take your black ass home. I'm just saying. There are relative differences among the competing varieties of ethnic origin. So what's interesting, it seems to me, that in this debate about immigrants, race makes a difference despite the fact we say it doesn't. Ethnicity makes a difference despite the fact we say it doesn't on all sides. How do we come to grips with legitimate concerns about borders without turning them into borders of fear? An American in the aftermath of 9/11 now knows what it means to be a vulnerable population. Can't control what people think about you, don't know why they keep hating you. Despite all the good you do and the good stuff you say and the aid you send and the love you share, they still hate you. Welcome to the world of most minorities. Welcome to the world of what it means to now not no matter how clean or articulate you are and fresh. Who knew that when we discoursed about the influence of rap music, we'd have to call an American senator as case number one? I mean, didn't Joe Biden get deeply influenced by Outkast, the group? You're so fresh and so clean. He looks at Barack Obama, the first good-looking guy he's seen. He don't want to be too homoerotic. He the first good-looking dude you've seen. Man, slow down. Mainstream, what does that mean? That means he's like us. He's got a pedigree like us. Undergraduate Columbia, graduate school at Harvard. There's been a few more brothers done that. Not a few more brothers who have done that. A few more brothers done that. Have engaged in that practice and that trajectory. And isn't it interesting? All Biden, he didn't mean no harm. But he reveals some interesting faux pas, doesn't he? He reveals the fact that, well, the rest of y'all ain't really that articulate. He an exception. So you don't make Barack an extension of, you make him an exception to a tradition. Oh, how well dost thou sleep? Because, are you saying Jesse Jackson wasn't articulate beyond belief and eloquent? Did you listen to him in 84 or 88? Our time has come from the outhouse to the White House. When he said, they catch the early bus, these women who make up the battalion of the working poor. In our tradition, as much as I love him, in our tradition of rhetorical genius and the manipulation of words for the purposes of defending the vulnerable and articulating visions that should be, Mr. Barack Obama, in comparison to Jesse or Al Sharpton or Martin Luther King Jr., weighs in not as heavily. That doesn't discount the fact that as a United States senator, he's one of the most eloquent men alive. There are no essential contradictions in that. It's just that if you ain't hip to the black tradition of rhetoric, then you praising something you don't really know what you're talking about. The average brother on a Sunday morning preaching got some eloquence, man. Sister who's putting it down, let's listen to them. Incredible training in the service of truth-telling in alliance with our own vernacular tradition has been amazing. And so in the 5 minutes I got left, when you think about that, so you're not saying that Barack is somehow part of a resonant tradition with which you have grappled because of your own ignorance. You praise him without recognizing that he comes from a long tradition of rhetoric. But it does also mean that because you disagree with Jesse Jackson's politics, you can't concede his eloquence. And Barack Obama, is not part of the civil rights tradition. Therefore, he's safer to you. He's a lighter-skinned Negro, as they say. Lighter-skinned, not light-skinned. Lighter-skinned, it's in our tradition. Mama white. Then some black people got the nerve, well, is he really black? Now we're going to genetically profile the cat? Now we're going to DNA profile him? Look at me. Somebody been in the gene pool. On radio, I'm a light-skinned Negro, if y'all can't tell. So look at me. Somebody. Now, Barack is a metaphor for all of us. Whether it's your mama, your grandmama, your great-grandmama, your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmama, somebody been in the gene pool. Thomas Jefferson. Doubting during the day the abstract capacity of reasoning for the Negro, but at night, dipping into the slave quarters with a gaggle of Luther Vandross tapes. That's Brian Greene, time, space, Einsteinian thing. He just saw the future, knew Luther was good, and grabbed him. So the point is that there's always been a little genetic chicanery going on. And for us to ask the color of his skin and not the color of his politics is ludicrous. And I'm glad he won a Grammy this year. It's ludicrous. And so the point is that we must base our judgments upon him, not by dismissing him a priori out of the hand because he's seems to be from another racial planet. And at the same time, let's not valorize and elevate and exaggerate what he is because we're ignorant of the tradition from which he springs. And finally, in this book, I talk about the beef between older and younger black people on the hip-hop tip. I debated John McCain in the Senate upon this. Mr. McCain said to me, Mr. Dyson, we're concerned about the corrupting influence of money upon young people. I said, oh, my God, are you speaking about the United States Senate? It's in the book. Read it. And so we had a tete-a-tete, an exchange of vigorous differences. Until John Kerry got involved and we started debating about the monkeys. Not at the zoo, but as a group who was derivative, which was derivative of the Beatles. And I defended Mickey Dolenz. Hey, hey, we're the monkeys. Got to defend that because I'm a man with Catholic small C tastes. I love country music. So I wanted it to come through. You know, blackness is a complex phenomena. I'm proud to be an Okie from Muskogee. That anti-Vietnam Merle Haggard wouldn't even look at a brother like me and see me as an ally, but yet I'm listening to his music. Or the possum, George Jones. He stopped loving her today. My God, that's enough to sop it up and suck it in. One of the greatest country songs ever written. And the reason he stopped loving her because he was dead, but go listen to the song. It's a deep thing. So my point is that blackness and race identity and ethnicity converge. And so when I hear people beating up on hip-hop, I mean, when Jay-Z releases his most recent album, it's so grown up, but people can't even deal with the grown-up Jay-Z. 30's the new 20, brother, I'm so hot still. Better bra, better automobile. Yes, I might release a rap album in a couple years when I turn 50. 50's the new 40, brother, I'm so hot still. I'm celebrating anything that's worth dealing with old people. And rap music grows up and becomes conscious of its lethal intentions and intensities toward women. The black church ought to do the same thing. Maybe the white church, maybe the synagogue, the temple, the mosque, maybe people who follow Jesus or Allah or God or whatever you call it. Him, her, the deity, whatever you use to sanctify and justify your subordination of women. whether Jay-Z does it, or whether Tupac does it, or whether Snoop Dogg does it and viciously, vilely assaults women, or whether they go to church or some religious ashram or some sanctuary that allows them to, as women, constitute 75 to 80% of the membership as they give their tithes, their money, and their support to a minister who will then tell them that God doesn't intend them to be equal to the man with whom God has blessed them. Just get to the point like hip-hop. Call him a hoe. And so I talk about a bit of this in the book as well. Needless to say, there are many conversations, dialogues, and debates that we need to have in this nation, and the joy of the exchange is nearly as hedonistic and as helpful as the possibility that what we shall say shall transform the world in which we live. Thank you for listening.
Thank you to Michael Eric Dyson for his comments this afternoon. And might I say before we start the question and answer that I just got a text message from Senator Joe Biden, and he says that he includes you in his pantheon of articulate. But so congratulations.
Tell him I'll cast and I thank him together. Yeah.
We have a whole stack of questions, and I'll try and get through them as fast as you can answer them.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll start with something that's somewhat local here, but then blew up all over America, and that was a recent story in Asian Week by a young 22-year-old columnist that went, "I hate blacks." Now, yeah. Asian Week has since, as you said in your speech about in another context, it messed up, it fessed up, it said we shouldn't have done it. Should we just accept the apology, move on, or what is the larger story here?
Well, I think that Brother Kenneth Hing, I believe, is the young person who wrote the piece about hating black people. I think we take it as an opportunity to not vilify him, but to bore into a seething underlying passion that has to be explicitly articulated and then explicitly embraced. That is to say, not the prejudice, but the conversation. We got to have a conversation about what it means to be different in this nation. What it means to have relationships between Latinos and black people and white people and Latinos, but especially between black and certain varieties of Asian communities, Pan-Asian communities, and in even more particularly, given the Korean black tensions in, say, Los Angeles, California, or in New York City. So I think that Brother Ng represents a growing sentiment in some communities, especially second, third, fourth generation Asian brothers and sisters who are here, who may have disagreements with, disgruntlements with, or rearticulations of stereotypes about black people. There could be legitimate differences that need to be articulated, that's fine, but to cast them as a form of hatred misses the opportunity to engage in edifying conversation and debate about difference. Now, despite the fact that he phrased it that way, very provocative, very inflammatory, I think that it would be a mistake to think he's pretty much a solo gunslinger as opposed to be part of a posse. So what we got to do is to figure out what's the underlying current, what's feeding it, what's nurturing it, what continues it, and then try to grasp it at its root as opposed to vilify him as his expression. He needs to be put in check and then therefore placed in a kind of debate context where his ideas are challenged. But he is expressing, I think, a more broadly held sentiment than we perhaps are aware of or are comfortable in admitting.
So do you feel that the U.S. government and media perpetuate racial strife between minorities? It was one of the comments I remember reading about in response to the Asian Week article was from Asians who then said, well, we didn't hear that much of an outcry when Ms. Jones was making derogatory comments about Asian after the tsunami. And sure. So there becomes a comparison of the decibel level of the outrage.
Sure, no doubt. But she was suspended immediately. And immediately with the Asian congressman, councilman in New York, who immediately moved to have her removed, and there was broad support among African-American people who felt that that viewpoint of Ms. Jones about the tsunami making a joke along with her supporting cast was not only suspended, but a great deal was made of it. So I think that still, having said that, however, it is true that the media does exaggerate and play up, but we act like the media
is something outside of the immediate presence of citizens in America. The media comes from our community. Now, it is a machinery unto itself, operating the way Reinhold Niebuhr said, you know, when you're individual, you act a certain way. When you're part of a group, there's a kind of group think that takes over, and that commandeers a certain kind of sentiment and passion. So that's not to be denied. But at the same time, I think that, again, we've got to use it as an opportunity to see not only how the media may fan and fuel and flame it, because look at what's happening in L.A. right now with Black-Latino tensions in terms of the jails and the murders that are occurring outside of it flowing forth. The media may comment on it, may inflame it, but if it ain't there, they can't do much with it. So there's a way in which we've got to both acknowledge the construction of these images and identities by a media that has no good intention toward any of these groups. It's not like the media is sitting around giving tremendously complex viewpoints of black people or Latinos or Asian folk so that when we see these kind of conflagrations that we immediately recognize them because the media itself is guilty. The media has not done explicitly what these people have done in their vicious bigotry, but it has, by its indifference to complexity, perpetuated the atmosphere that allows those kind of bigotries to prosper. And that's what we got to tell the truth about.
I love how all these questions are sort of really, it's as if somebody was following the flow along and interlocked all the questions, because this follows totally from what you were just talking about. To truly establish racial equality one day, all groups must play a role, black, white, Latino, Asian, etc. Mm-hmm. What are the roles and responsibilities, and how do they differ between the groups?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. There is equal investment, though not equal responsibility, right? See, if your parents say, well, when I go away, I'm going to make you responsible, true, you know, you're the oldest. But if the youngest person in the group is the one that put all the toothpaste all over the mirrors, and you come back and you held responsible because you're supposed to be controlling them, you get my point. You might get punished, but the point is that the younger person still is the one that did all the toothpaste smearing on the window. And in America, that's an inexact metaphor that doesn't walk on all fours, but let me try to at least hoist it up on two legs. In America, you know, it amazes me that we now want everybody to be equally responsible. Everybody has an equal investment in making sure that racial difference is dealt with in a constructive and nonviolent fashion. All of us have that investment. But everybody ain't equally responsible for the mess we in. Right? Because everybody ain't been the beneficiaries of and privileges of white supremacy. I don't mean white supremacy in terms of individual white brothers and sisters sitting around going, oh, I can't stand black people. No, I don't mean that at all. Or Asian people or Native Americans. I'm talking about institutional expressions of practices that have a life of their own. In fact, the ingenuity of white supremacy is that it does not demand any individual to be in place in order for the machinery to perpetuate itself. What I mean by white supremacy is the conscious or unconscious belief in the notion that one group is inferior and another group is superior, predicated upon nothing else but pigment, skin color, and the privileges and associations of intellectual superiority and cultural superiority associated with it. And that has meant that many cases, First Nation people, Indigenous people, Native American people have been seen as inferior, brown people have been seen as inferior, so-called yellow people, though insulting to them, so some have taken that term up, have been seen as inferior, black people have been seen as inferior. That ain't equal. That's one constant theme of white supremacy that has punished many white people themselves. Most white people themselves see it as offensive. It's a burden, after all, to assume that you're supreme in a nation where you know you really ain't. That's a burden, too. Your guilt. The guilt that many white people, I'm supposed to be superior, but when I see a person of another group that's manifestly superior to me, who's clean and articulate and well-dressed, it becomes problematic. But then you see them as an exception. For your own ego's sake, well, maybe they're an exception. They're not the regular. It's not most black people are not that well-spoken. But damn, you got Barack Obama. Then you got Condoleezza Rice. Then you got Colin Powell and Jesse Jackson. My God, there are a few of them. So then that burden that you carry dissipates under the burden of countervailing evidence, disconfirming data. But then what do you do with that? Do you get angry or resentful and you get mad? Do you acknowledge that white supremacy has been a hoax on all of people, including white people? Or do we most likely just lay back in the cut, so to speak, and continue to be advantaged by a system that we claim we don't participate in? Many white people say, well, hey, I wasn't there. That was my great-great-great-great-grandmom and them. But see, you still appeal to the Declaration of Independence. It wasn't written when you were alive. But you still use it when you go to court, habeas corpus, and a whole bunch of stuff that was here long before you were here. So all my point is this, is that even though everybody has an equal investment in the negotiation of racial difference and owning up to our tribe's prejudices, let's not pretend that everybody's equally responsible for the racial mess we're in, because that has a consistent pattern of reference to ideals and practices initiated in this country in association with manifest destiny, with the notion of democracy being indivisible from the privileges of white men who own land who could vote. And then, therefore, it's hard to ask people to own up to that privilege and responsibility without looking like you're pointing the finger and saying, aha. But at the same time, we even ask poor people to be responsible for their fate. But when we flip the script and say, well, if you want poor people who are vulnerable without resource to be responsible for their fate, how come we can't ask America to own up to its fate and the dominant mainstream majority in this nation to own up to it? These are uncomfortable truths, but unless we deal with them, I don't think we're going to get very far. Though, at the same time, on a practical level, all of us have equal responsibility to make certain that racial difference and violence and bigotry and ignorance are stamped out in our own lives, our own mouths, and certainly in our own communities.
Since Dr. Ward Connolly isn't here, I'm going to have to play
Mr.
Ward Connolly for you and ask...
He ain't that fresh and articulate.
And ask you, and you have the debate you had in the book, ask you, how will affirmative action best serve the nation, not just the past, and as in how it's done as a report card on affirmative action, but in the years ahead?
Well, certainly. I mean, first of all, if you ain't dealt with the past, it certainly has an effect on the present. I hate to sound like George Santayana, but if you don't deal with the past, it's bound to repeat itself, and it's bound to recycle itself through you. Number one. Number two, affirmative action doesn't deal exclusively or even primarily with past discrimination. It deals with the persistent patterns of discrimination in the present. The stuff I mentioned about white guy with a criminal record, black guy can't get a job, that ain't the past. I'm talking about now. And the more difficult, nuanced, complex areas of racial privilege are hard to get at. Take a couple. You know, you can't prove when you go get a job and you're looking for a job and you get interviewed if you get in. Now you can't even get in if your name is Shanae or Shaniqua or Taliqua. Even black comedians are beating up on you for that. And the prejudice that the studies have shown that you can't even get a call back, and you might have a master's degree from Harvard. But the racial profiling, the name profiling, which suggests you belong to a certain group, will keep you out. Let me tell you where else white privilege makes a huge difference. Now, that's big money, jobs, distribution of economic resource. But look where else it manifests itself. Just in the everyday level, if a policeman sees you reaching for your wallet and doesn't assume it's a gun, that's huge, because that means you might not get killed. That means if you're going out to have a little birthday party or a little celebration before you get married, that the police won't shoot at you 50 times. Now, you know, you don't know what a privilege that is. Even if you were a poor white person and ain't got no money, and you say, wait a minute, you black people have a lot of money, and some of you, and you do much better than I am, what privilege do I have? The ability to live and breathe free of the contamination of bigotry that may lead to your death. That's bigger than money. Because when a policeman sees you, he doesn't automatically assume that you are out to do him harm. And therefore, his trigger finger won't be as likely to go off and to murder you. That's huge. So for me, when we look at the practices, we're not just talking about the past. We're talking about the present. And affirmative action simply says this. Relatively speaking, with two relatively equal candidates for a job or a slot in school, relatively equal candidates will give the nod to the historically excluded African-American or Asian brother or white woman, who mostly benefits from affirmative action, or other abled person. Most of the beneficiaries of affirmative action are not black people. They're white women in concert with other abled white brothers and sisters. When you put those numbers together, they're overwhelmingly the beneficiaries of a policy put in practice as a result of our racial struggle. My God, the Elvis Presleyization of even racial rhetoric. Our suffering allows it to occur. Others benefit from it in appropriating it for their benefit. That's cool, because we live in a nation where we understand that what's good for black people is good for everybody.
But let's not demonize black people as the exclusive beneficiaries of a program that have spread out, metastasized in this body politic far beyond the cells of black privilege. And so affirmative action is about giving people a chance who deserve to have a chance. If Michael Jordan was born 80 years ago, you wouldn't even know his name. Are you telling me a practice that says let a guy like Michael Jordan play is about letting somebody who's inferior in? Immediately you will say, well, everybody's not Michael Jordan. Well, ain't nobody who was white against him was Michael Jordan, right? A world of Bob Cousy's and Larry Bird's is great, but a world of LeBron James's and Michael Jordan's and Kobe Bryant's is magnificent.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Michael Eric Dyson, who is discussing his new book, Debating Race with Michael Eric Dyson. Moving on to politics, the question here, you recently emceed a gathering of the Black Congressional Caucus. How would you characterize their current power and influence? And piggybacking onto that, why isn't somebody like John Conyers, longtime representative from Detroit and head of the Judicial Committee in Congress, being seriously considered as a presidential candidate?
Yeah, I'll take the latter first. He's a member of my church in Detroit where I grew up. Love John Conyers. What a great man, the longest-serving African-American, the dean of the nation's black politicians, and a man of incredible stamina and commitment to racial justice and American democracy. Without him, Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday would not be now celebrated as a national holiday, and jazz would not be seen officially as a treasure of America, and so many other contributions he's made. So amen to that. In terms of the Black Caucus, yeah, I did MC the program of their swearing in, and it was quite interesting, and I had a chance to introduce both Barack Obama and Jesse Jackson. Barack, the potential black president, meet Jesse Jackson, the man who made the way for you to become what you are. See, I don't like that either-or kind of thing. How come it can't be both of them? Both. Without Jesse Jackson, Barack Obama can't even exist, stand up, and articulate his name in the same way, because Jesse cleared the path. You know, when a running back is doing some great running, look at the line. Who cleared that hole for you, homeboy? Because if you run up against a cement wall, you ain't going nowhere but on the ground. So Jesse Jackson been doing some big blocking, clearing for Mr. Obama to run through those holes. So we need to recognize both the line man and the running back. It was interesting to introduce Mr. William Jefferson from Louisiana. Look, his people put him back in. What am I going to say? I got to introduce the brother. Although I did call upon the renowned philosopher Sean Carter, better known to some of you as Jay-Z, when I said, what can I say about this brother? Perhaps the philosopher Sean Carter said it best, damn though, man, I'm just trying to do me. If the record's 2 mil, I'm just trying to move 3. Those who have ears, let them hear. But I think that the Congressional Black Caucus is strong. Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick is the leader now from Detroit. Incredibly, amazingly articulate, fresh, beautiful, brilliant leader who I think is giving a new energy and vision and voice to the Congressional Black Caucus. And I think they, as always, are players to be dealt with, even though some would marginalize them as a caucus only concerned about African-American interests, where what they're concerned about really is good for American democracy.
Still on politics, and since you brought up Senator Barack Obama, very simple question. Can Barack Obama really win? And do the stories like, is he a African or a African, or is he black enough? Do stories like those matter?
Well, they matter. We talk about them. We in America. Let's not pretend. See, let's not put this authenticity question on black folk, because Biden is the one who really raises the question in an interesting way, because, you know, if you can't ever accept the fact that you got articulate, intelligent black people doing their thing, and if you're fascinated by that, that's beautiful. It's not to suggest that black people who are articulate shouldn't be recognized as such. It's just that the implicit comparison to others who have not been or who are not thought to be really, in one sense, ignores the fact that most white folk can't be as articulate as Barack Obama. Forget the rest of the Negroes. I mean, damn, you acting like it's all the rest of the white folk are, by jing it. Though much is taken, much abides, and though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are, we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts made weak by time and fate, but strong in will, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. Nah, that ain't how to go. I teach at predominantly white schools. Love white kids, but come on. Come on. Eloquence is not the first reserve
of our white brothers and sisters. Love them to death. So let's not give them a pass like they be speaking the English well. They talking the King's English to the Queen's taste while everybody else messing it up. No siree. Paris Hilton, all I need to say. So having said that, Barack Obama is a hell of a phenomenon, isn't he? I mean, isn't it? What's the downside? You know, if I run and don't win, I'm going to be the leader of the Democrats along with Hillary. Depends on what happens. And I go back to the Senate and I can run again later. What's the downside? I mean, is he black enough? I've dealt with that in my speech. Come on. I mean, what does that even mean? But the response of black people to black enough comes from people who, with that kind of pedigree, sometimes have tricked black people. Let's be honest. So let's not act like we don't know where that question comes from. Because what they're really saying is, can we trust you? You get Clarence Thomas up on, you know, eat black people. Now, the same black people who defended Clarence Thomas and R. Kelly ain't going to give Barack Obama a chance. And I ain't saying, look, I ain't seen the tape with R. Kelly. I don't know. All I know is I love the music. I got to be honest. And if you still love Thomas Jefferson, you might as well love R. Kelly. Because Thomas Jefferson was with a 14-year-old, 13-year-old girl, and he owned her. And they talking about a love relationship. And he ain't even wrote Step in the Name of Love. All he wrote was the Declaration of Independence, damn it. He ain't wrote no serious jams. So I'm saying. But the same black people who believe OJ is innocent ain't going to give Barack a chance. What? You going to give OJ? He didn't do it. See, what had happened was. What? But you don't want to give Barack a chance. But slice him, dice him, OJ. I'm talking about his running style. I know nothing else. I know he's your homeboy, Potrero Hill. Y'all getting kind of funky up in here. San Fran. I know. I'm just saying. Gonna give him a chance, but not Barack. Just think about that. I think he's got a chance. Yeah, he got 1 in 3 chance. I mean, heck, he the one that got the greatest chance ever of us to get out there. He can't be like me and be in the White House. I can be critical of that. I got criticisms of him, and I love him, and he's my man. But at the end of the day, we're not going to give him a shot when he's got a chance, because a guy like me with my kind of politics can't get into the White House except to slink in the Lincoln bedroom, if I get invited there and not tied up there. So my question is, you know, we know he's a centrist. That's what it takes to get up into that space. Then we're going to hold him accountable, too. Doesn't mean that you automatically have to vote for him because you're black. That's ridiculous, too, right? Because black people don't believe in pigment politics. Show us the money. Show us your commitment. I'd rather go with Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court than Clarence Thomas any day of the week. So I think that's where we stand on that.
Well, it's not quite Lincoln or Jefferson, but what should Strom Thurmond's family do for Al Sharpton? Or alternatively, if you want to broaden it, what is the status of reparations and what should still happen?
I think Strom Thurmond's family should have the Al Sharpton reading room. Man, what a story, huh? These damn genetics are something else, ain't they? We all related. You hating on somebody you own, and own somebody you know somebody you love somebody you own somebody who's your relative. It's all promiscuous and incestuous. The hell is wrong with America? Racial hatred is so ultimately insane. Because we're all intermingled and all interrelated in a fundamental way. So, reparations, I say, yeah. You know, all these, I debated Ward Connolly about this, and of course, David Horowitz. If you don't want it, step out of line. A lot of people who need it. Reparations is just not about getting money, it's about owning up to the responsibility of America. America always preaches responsibility, except when it comes to itself. Isn't it interesting? You want everybody to be responsible, except you, the government. They can't even be responsible to black people down in Hurricane Katrina. And if this is what the nation does when the cameras are rolling. See, y'all, white people don't often think about that. Hell, he's got a point there. That's what they do to Negroes when the cameras are rolling. What the hell do you think happens when nobody is watching? And not just the black people. Poor white folk, Vietnamese, shrimpers, 6 Native American tribes, and about several different varieties of Asians. I'm just telling you, that's what they do when the camera's rolling. So, to me, that says that we're all interrelated, and reparations is necessary in terms of education and opportunity. I mean, we need to build schools right here in America where kids can have opportunity to go to school, right? Down in down in Louisiana right now, 400, 600 kids are out of school. Teachers are being put out of their jobs in New Orleans. We got to the tsunami, talking about the tsunami, in 24 hours. But we can't get to black people and others down in New Orleans in 5 days. This is the travesty and tragedy of racial oppression and bigotry. Because if Barbara Bush-like looking women would have been down there, do you tell me they wouldn't have tried to get down there any faster? Just think about it. At that level, complexion is critical, though it signifies for a broader universe and ocean of racial belief and practice. All I'm saying to you is that reparations is about saying, we messed up. Let's try to do something about it. Let's find the most feasible fashion in which to forge solidarity and connection with our vulnerable citizens of color, whom we exploited for years.
What do you think of the idea, though, of using race-based tax credits as a strategy for reparations? Because conservatives often use tax credits or deductions rather than expenditures to advance social policies.
Hey, I'm down with that. I could use a break right now, man. I'm getting audited. You know, I don't know if y'all saw George Bush, you know, when Brian Williams had me on his show one night. Boy, I should have never done that. Then the next, and I said, hey, I think George Bush is a patrician. He don't mean no harm. He don't understand. And then the next night, what does Brian Williams say to the president in his face? Last night on our program, Professor Dyson from the University of Pennsylvania said that it's because of your patrician upbringing. Oh, thank you, Brian. Thank you. I don't know. Dyson doesn't know me. I don't know Dyson. The Professor Dysons of the world say things. Ain't never been audited before. I'm getting audited right now. Now, I ain't even no conspiracy theorist, but damn, it don't take no genius to figure that out. I knew immediately I was getting audited. As soon as he said that, I said, I'm getting audited this year. This is the first year I'm going to have to pay my taxes, man, because I'm getting audited right now. I believe in that. They probably catch me up in that. Isn't that a scandal going on now with Wesley Snipes? That's part of his thing because somebody told him that as a protest with slavery, just don't pay your taxes? Yeah, I'm with you on that, but I had to pay mine, brother. I think there are all kind of creative ways in which tax-based, you know, credits and the like, you know, transfer payments. I think that setting aside money for kids to go to school. How about poor women who need child support and the ability to go to school or work and have somebody take care of their kids? There are all kind of ways that we can talk about reparations that I think would be practical, feasible, and I think that many Americans would ultimately agree with.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Today's speaker is Michael Eric Dyson, talking about his new book, Debating Race with Michael Eric Dyson. You brought up New Orleans. Fast forward 10 years, what will New Orleans look like demographically, politically, and why?
Whiter, richer, and more like Disneyland, you know, and more conservative. I think that in 10 years from now, unfortunately, New Orleans won't have recovered significantly for those African-American people, and people are mad at Ray Nagin for calling it a chocolate city. It was 70% damn near black before the storm. That's pretty chocolate. That ain't vanilla. Why do people get, how dare you? What are you saying? You don't want white people back. We're Caucasoids, and we deserve to be there along with the Negroids. I can dig that. If you thought he was saying that, I could understand you going like, but damn, you know, we up in there too. Don't be trying to diss us. So I'm down with that. But I don't think that's what he was saying, because he's a basically conservative Republican dude who was a Cox Cable Network executive, Republican, supported Bobby Jindal against Kathleen Blanco in the governor's race. That's why they didn't have no love. I'm just giving you the inside story here. And so this ain't no radical, you know, black leader. Ray Nagin? Right. Ray Nagin is the one who debated all night when he was told at 6 o'clock that this was the worst storm that the National Weather Service director had ever seen until 10 o'clock the next morning before announcing a mandatory evacuation. Black man. Because he consulted with the business community to determine if they would sue him or not. Black man. That's why you can't play no politics of pigment here. I mean, Ray Nagin, and plus, it ain't in no chocolate city anymore anyway. Go down there. It's basically a Reese's Pieces city. Black and brown. A lot of Mexicans and other Central Americans and other people coming down there. You got some chocolate in my peanut butter. You got some peanut butter in my chocolate. You got Reese's Pieces. It's a Reese's Pieces city right now, bro. You know, Halliburton, all them companies, $100 million, no bid contracts, bidding out the job for $60, pay a Mexican $9, pocket the, what's left, 51? I can't count. I ain't no math major. See what I'm saying? So the exploitation, disaster capitalism, as Naomi Klein talks about it, is going on. And I fear that a lot of those black people, if they were too poor to leave, do you think they got money to come back? Just think about it. They're going to get kept out. They're going to get locked out. The president didn't even mention them. I mean, my God, have the decency to acknowledge their humanity and existence as opposed to ignoring them. So I think in 10 years, New Orleans will be a playland for the wealthy. I think the Central Business District will do well. Mardi Gras will be great. But the masses of African-American people will still be recovering. There will be much smaller numbers there, and it will be a whiter, more conservative, richer paradise for those so inclined to go.
What is your reaction to the recent emotional outrage about the housing conditions at Walter Reed when so many poor people live in similar inhumane housing?
Well, you know, it's not a zero-sum thing. I am outraged, along with those who are outraged at Walter Reed with the military. But that's a great point, though, that poor people every day are getting beat up on, with this exception. This is why my debate with Bill Cosby got so heated and remain so, is because, I don't know if y'all saw the NAACP Image Awards this past Friday on television. It was on Fox. It ain't on the black network. Y'all could have checked it out. Now, come on. Bono was on there. Bono was great, right? I mean, Bill Cosby got inducted into the Hall of Fame, and Bono got the, I don't know, President's Award, Chairman's Award. And this illustrates to me the difference in the Walter Reed, because ain't nobody from the military come out. Them damn military people at the Walter, they don't deserve. They're lazy. If they didn't go to war and get their limbs blown off, they wouldn't be there in the first place. Now, if you heard somebody say that, you would think they're out of their damn minds, wouldn't you? What? But what is Bill Cosby basically saying? Same difference about the poor black people. If you didn't take care of the things and the jello and the people... Right? He's just beating up, got his foot on the neck of vulnerable black people. Bono is trying to destroy poverty. Bill Cosby trying to destroy poor black people. It's a hell of a difference. And I ain't going to act like, because I'm a halfway teaspoon full of influence, visible public intellectual, for solidarity with a Negro who's trying to hurt poor black people. Don't call me out. How dare you say something to him? Why don't you get mad at him for calling out millions of black people without any information? He's famous. That don't mean he's smart. Just because he say it don't mean it's true. We get hoodwinked. Well, he gave a bunch of money. Are you going to let him rape your daughter? So there are always limits to even what money will procure. So we know there are limits imposed upon people. That's an extreme example. I'm just making a point. So my point simply is this, is that when we look at poor people, yeah, it's horrible. But the difference in Walter Reed is the advocates who should be helping poor black people out are the ones putting their foot on their necks. Incinerating discourse that has no possibility of opening up dialogue and talking about how we can relieve the suffering of the poor. Bono comes on, appeals to, the poetry and anger of the black pulpit that I learned as I grew up in Ireland, traveled all the way over there. And now, as a result of that, I want to destroy poverty. He said, we can destroy poverty in our lifetime. Now, he's been to Africa. He could be saying, these African tribes, they're crazy. I don't know what they're doing. I don't understand. Right? Bono could have done that. Could have wrote a song about it. All he's doing is trying to destroy the poverty. And we got a comedian trying to destroy the poor. Won't you see that? And that's the difference. Walter Reed is lamentable. But until the social supports for that situation of the black poor is not held up by those who claim to be part of our community, then we're in a much different situation. The advocates of the poor, in other words, have to be much stronger and much more articulate.
We're almost out of time, so just in time to go out into the rest of the world, you know, go into a whole different arena. But what do you think of Oprah's African Academy for Young Women, and what future impact will this have on the world?
Love her. Love her for doing it. Love her for helping those African girls. You know, some people got mad. How come they're only African? They're mostly black African as opposed to white. There are a few white girls up in there, but she said the percentage is mostly black kids over there who are poor, who are girls who are black, so why? Come on. They don't have any support. Love what she's doing, 300 thread counts, sheets, silk. How dare they deserve that? Why don't they deserve that? How come poor people just, I guess they just don't deserve stuff. But here's a contradiction, though. And I was sad to see Miss Winfrey respond the way she did when asked about black kids in America. See, that's why we always got to help somebody at our expense. I just, damn, can you get out of the conversation without crapping on your own? Even inadvertently, didn't even mean to, perhaps. She said, hey, I've been to the inner city schools. Abandon them, can't go. Tired. Now, don't get me wrong. I understand. If you've ever been up in those schools, you know it's tough. I go into them. I know it's rough. Sometimes you won't go like, damn. It's like worse than a war zone. It's like worse than Beirut. It's crazy. But they're your people. Don't give up. So then she said, I don't go there anymore. I'm frustrated. There's no learning going on there. Oh, my God. Or people don't want to learn. And then she says, those kids want iPods and sneakers and not uniforms like they do in South Africa. But if you read O Magazine 2 years ago, she was frustrated with the kids in South Africa because all they wanted was iPods and sneakers. So, come on. And let's do a rational choice theory here. The uniform lasts you about 2 years, maybe three. iPod, you got music from Mozart to Mos Def. 4 centuries. That's a damn better choice. And you know the sneakers going to last, Nike. So I'm saying, why can't poor people want stuff? And when we asked Miss Winfrey, when you were going to Hermes, it wasn't to lead a civil rights movement. Trying to buy $8,000? Was it purse, watch, Birkin bag? I don't know. I'm saying you weren't trying to lead no civil rights movement. You were trying to get a bag for Tina Turner or somebody. Hell, they wouldn't let you in. Now, I was mad that they didn't let you in. But you wasn't trying to lead a march. You were trying to buy a bag. And I'm saying, be honest about that then. And you know what? Can't nobody tell you how to spend your money because you do it. You're a beautiful woman. I love Oprah and what she does. But damn it, at the same time, don't crap on the people who are here by saying these kids need schools too in South Central like they do in South Africa. They need schools in Chicago right where you live. Devastating conditions. And many of them have been taught to believe that they shouldn't aspire to something deeper or higher or better. So then we need to occupy their minds with hope and possibility, inseminate them with the virus of potential. That's what we need as well. I love her, love amazing work that she does, but at the same time, don't reinforce prevailing stereotypes about black kids unless we really understand what they're up against, which is why I love Susan Taylor from Essence, who's doing the Essence Cares and spreading the hopeful message of redeeming and rehabilitating our kids.
We're out of time, but I wanted to say one 15-second response to this two-word question. It's just two words. And it says, solutions, ? hope?
Listen to the lecture. Check the books. Can't do it in 15 seconds. Holla.
Thanks to Michael Eric Dyson, renowned academic, public intellectual, and as we found out today, singer as well, and author of Debating Race with Michael Eric Dyson. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Sandeep Roy, and now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.